You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I want to welcome you all to Carnegie. My name is David Burwell. I'm with the Energy and Climate Program here at Carnegie. I'll start off with a little advertisement. Carnegie's Energy and Climate Program is about 3.5 years old. It's focused on traditionally on climate, China and the United States, but it's in expansion mode now. We've added a focus on Russia. Adnan Vattenzerver in the back is our Russian guy, and Europe as well. We're hopefully going to expand to that area. And most importantly, well, not most importantly, but for me it is, we want to have a focus on domestic energy and climate issues as well. And in that regard, the focus of each of these centers is slightly different, but the one domestically is going to focus on transportation carbon and specifically carbon pricing, transportation carbon pricing. So obviously that's the reason for this event and a discussion of the Kerry Lieberman bill, because it is the one of the proposals on the table for pricing transportation carbon. I will introduce our panelists in a minute. You have their bios right here. Just a little bit of background. Obviously, pricing carbon is a central way of managing carbon consumption. This strategy has a unique and difficulty in the transportation sector, because not only do we want to reduce transportation carbon, but the transportation sector is dependent on burning carbon to finance the program. So there's an internal conflict here between public policy to control carbon, transportation carbon, and to actually finance the system. So the panelists today will talk about that. The process, I think we'll have each of the panelists speak for about 10 to 13 minutes. I will then make a few comments. I'll reserve the right to ask the first question, and hopefully we'll have about half an hour or 40 minutes for a general discussion. So my panelists today, we have an excellent team, and I'm very pleased to have them with us here at Carnegie. First, we have Vicky Arroyo, who is the director of the Georgetown, the Climate Center at Georgetown Law School, Law Center. Vicky is sitting in. We had a little reshuffling here because James Corliss, who is representing the Transportation for America Coalition, had to leave, was out of town today. And Darren was going to be present the climate bill itself and the context about transportation financing and pricing within the context of the other competing claimants to revenues from a carbon pricing scheme. So with James gone, we're putting Darren on to represent Transportation for America. Vicky is going to present the climate bill itself. Vicky has a long history of being involved in domestic climate and energy policies with the Pew Center for Climate Change before being at Georgetown. She also worked at EPA. So thank Vicky for coming. Second, this is kind of a pro-con kind of discussion, or hopefully it'll be a friendly one. We are actually the Carnegie International Policy for Peace, so we'll have a tranquil discussion, I'm sure. Presentation in support of the particular scheme laid out in Kerry Lieberman, Darren Lovaas from NRDC, we'll give that. Darren is the Director of Transportation Policy at NRDC, has a long history in transportation and energy policy, and he is also on the executive committee of the Transportation for America Coalition. John Horsley is an old friend for a long period. I'm going to green him up a little bit. Everybody thinks of him as the gray infrastructure guy who just wants to build all the roads and all the bridges and stuff. But John is a fellow Peace Corps alumni with me, and in the Clinton administration as deputy secretary?
Associate deputy secretary.
One of those things. Associate deputy secretary for intermodal transportation. He and I worked closely with Janet on the Millennium Trails program, and John was a big trail rider, and we had lots of events and opportunities to ride bikes together on trails, so he's not just all about cars. So that's our team, and I think the format is that they will talk, and then we will have questions. I'll make the first question. So why don't we start with Vicki, who will present the context in which carbon pricing and transportation carbon pricing operates within the Carrie Lieberman bill.
Thanks, David. It's really an honor to be here, and I'll warn all of you in the audience that I actually called David. So you might have this experience yourself. That's why I'm telling you this. I called David 2 days ago for advice about something, and that's when he asked me to do this. So you might want to think twice before calling him and asking for advice, but no. I appreciate it, and I would certainly do anything he asks if I can. Just a few quick words about the Georgetown Climate Center for those of you who aren't familiar with us, because we've only been around a little bit over a year. We work to inform the federal dialogue on a variety of issues based largely on the state experience. We work very closely with the states. We're located in the Hall of States as well as at Georgetown Law Center. And then we also inform the states about how some of the federal policy developments will affect them. We work on climate, energy, and transport legislation, on regulation under the Clean Air Act, which is now, as you know, moving forward, on transportation as an important sector, and on adaptation. We also work with a governor's coalition on climate and energy policy and convene other dialogues as well. One of the things that I'm going to use to brief you today is an analysis that the full analysis is actually up on our website at www.georgetownclimate.org. Every time a climate bill comes out, we endeavor to get through it as quickly as possible and to summarize the state-relevant provisions of the climate bill. And so this is a bit different from some analyses you see around town that might be broader in their scope. We really try to zero in on the implications for the states. But that, of course, does, in this case, include the transportation planning provisions and other provisions that we'll be talking about today. My focus more recently has been on other concerns about state preemption of cap-and-trade programs and the Clean Air Act language and all of that. But just to first give you a broad outline of what's in the bill very, very briefly, and then focus on the transportation provisions, as David's asked me to do. So it begins, oddly enough, with a nuclear title. That hasn't happened before, to my knowledge, having seen all the iterations since the original McCain-Lieberman. So that was a bit of a surprise that the 900-and-something page bill started right there with, you know, nukes. The second section is about oil drilling, and it got modified right before it came out, because as you recall, that's when the disaster in the Gulf started. And so it was slightly modified. I think probably now it would be even more modified to include more of an opportunity for states to step in and decline offshore oil drilling if it might affect them based on an impacts assessment. And it also has provisions for revenue sharing with the states, with the coastal states, which had been negotiated before. There are many provisions that involve coal burning and capture and storage of the emissions from that, renewable and efficiency investments. And there is, contrary to maybe what you have heard in the press when people try to avoid the terms cap and trade, there is still very much alive and well a cap and trade over stationary sources, starting with electric generating units in 2012, phasing in natural gas and industrial sources, manufacturers over time. So in addition to transport, which we're focusing on today, there are clearly many players, many constituencies that are vying for allocation under this bill and concerned about how they're regulated under this bill. For transport, the bill does, again, maybe contrary to what you've heard, it does put a price on refined fuels. I think people have really tried to sort of capture the political moment and not be labeled in ways that they didn't find expedient. So, you know, cap and trade and tax or price on carbon, or including the fuels, transport fuels, has not always been transparent, but indeed they are in the bill. It also requires the development of a national transportation plan of planning goals for greenhouse gas emission reductions at the national level. It directs EPA to set standards for certain categories of mobile sources, and you see, obviously, the Obama administration moving forward with that in coordination with California. That is encouraged, again, post-2016, but California's ability to set its own car standards still survived some challenges, if you will. So far, the California car standard can still be more aggressive than the federal car, but the bill does urge cooperation with the auto companies and the feds post the current agreement, so post-2016. It invests in clean transportation infrastructure, including electric vehicle charging, fueling. And it directs the transportation plans of the states to consider things like oil reliance and the environmental impacts, greenhouse gas impacts, including land use patterns. It directs states and metropolitan planning organizations and similar entities to address transportation-related greenhouse gases by including emission reduction targets and strategies to meet those targets, so they have to do greenhouse gas targets and plans. It provides allowance revenue from the program for states and MPOs with approved greenhouse gas emission reduction programs. And those must be approved by DOT and EPA, who together are also directed in the bill to develop models and best practices to do all this, to measure and monitor and quantify this. So in order for the states and the MPOs to qualify for the allowance funding, they have to meet the requirements that DOT and EPA together set. There is up to $2.5 billion in the bill that goes to the Highway Trust Fund for purposes consistent with the transportation efficiency planning provisions and other relevant provisions of the bill. So, as I said before, there are many claims to the revenues that are generated from a bill like this, and many, as we see with what happened with the allocation, wanting and sometimes obtaining a free allocation of allowances. So, you know, for example, the electric generating sector got very generous allowances. They argue for the benefit of their customers through their load-serving entities, if you will, so the customers will sort of be able to transition more easily to seeing the price signal. One idea that's been getting more traction in recent years has been the idea of giving some back just directly to the public through a dividend. You know probably that Senators Cantwell and Collins have a bill to this effect. That idea is gaining traction, and you can see more of that trend now coming through in this bill. You see also the concerns about the deficit coming through with a deficit reduction amount that goes back to the kids. So the idea, as some of the politicians involved with the bill have said, is either we'll give it to you back in the form of some kind of rebate or to your children through deficit reduction. So these are some of the sort of theatrics around how to spend the money and the story that's being told about why it's important to spend it in certain ways. Within the transport sector, an average of about 7.3% allowances are being given, with a total of about $6.25 billion a year. Some say more, including the tax credits for the advanced vehicles, that it would be closer to $8 billion. So that's what comes back to the transport sector. And the breakdown there, as I mentioned earlier, is about $2.5 billion to the Highway Trust Fund, up to $1.875 billion to the discretionary Tiger Grant program, which, as you probably know, was created under the stimulus program and does include criteria for sustainability. Another $1.875 billion for a new competitive grant program to fund state and local projects that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and includes a set-aside to fund regional planning. There aren't official modeling results yet of exactly what the carbon price is likely to be under this bill and how much money it will generate. People are throwing around the number of about $20 billion from the transportation component, and, of course, that is the major component that's funding it. And so, you know, you can compare that number with the roughly $6 to $8 billion that's going to the sector, which is responsible for 30% of the emissions. And I think that, you know, you will hear a lively discussion about whether or not that's the right amount or not enough coming back to the sector. It's certainly more than we've seen in previous bills, for the transportation planning provisions. So there are advocacy groups that are praising it. Others will say that, again, because so much of the revenue is coming from the transportation sector through this linked fee or whatever you want to call it, that more should be coming just out of fairness and out of the many, many needs in that sector. So I'll let others wade into that debate more specifically. I will point out that I'm personally concerned that there's no money for adaptation in this sector, or frankly, any sector involving infrastructure or humans. I mean, it's very focused on the very limited funds for domestic adaptation on natural resources adaptation, and that's a difference from some of the earlier bills. One thought about just, you know, whether or not this pot is enough for transportation or how we might divvy it up. I had lived through the experience through my previous life at Pew of being part of some of the deliberations around U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which, as many of you who've been following this for the last few years know, was an influential group in forming at least the House version of the bill. And part of those deliberations involved lots and lots of meetings, long meetings, on really some of the tough zero-sum game kind of discussions around allocation. And, you know, what I learned from that is that, you know, when the electricity sector was sort of fighting with each other, nothing was really getting anywhere, both in the broader politics but also within their own sector. And one interesting thing that I observed in that process was that they actually sort of took the discussion off to their trade association, EEI, and tried to resolve it, because basically what you had was the clean energy company saying, you know, we're already paying more for our energy. It is, you know, more clean from a carbon perspective. We should be getting credit for that. And so you should give allowances to our industries based on the output of our electricity generation as opposed to based on our emissions, which rewards the dirty companies. Of course, the coal-based utilities were saying, hey, we have a long way to go. A lot of us operate in either, you know, very poor areas or in areas that are hard hit right now by the recession, the Rust Belt. You know, you really need to base your formula on grandfathered greenhouse gas emissions and give us the money that we need to transition these old coal plants and get, you know, put them away. And, you know, obviously there are merits to both of those arguments, and where you stand depends on where you sit. But what EEI did was to get them together, and they came up with a formula that worked enough that they could live with for both sides. And, you know, then you saw that formula literally adopted by the House bill. And so just, you know, as a possible model, knowing that this particular bill that we're talking about today, the Carrie Lieberman bill, is not, you know, likely to be the be-all and end-all in the final bill that we see on this, and we don't, in fact, know, you know, how transportation will fare in this bill moving forward. There are some rumors right now that some of the swing Democrats and Republicans, including Graham, who, as you know, sort of pulled off of the bill, are now floating the idea of maybe doing this in a sectoral, stepwise fashion, where we start with a cap and trade for utilities. The electric power folks have wanted the regulatory certainty for some time to put carbon with the other pollutants that they've been having to deal with and make changes. They would like to know what that package is. They'd obviously like to get their free allocation still. So one school of thought is maybe they move forward with something that looks more like a four-pollutant cap-and-trade bill this year, do transportation later, do the manufacturing sector, which, of course, has been hard hit by the recession and where you have competitiveness concerns, even later. I think, you know, who knows right now, given the oil spill, and the cries for something that would allow our government to be in a better position to respond to these kind of emergencies, I wonder whether or not there isn't an opportunity to do something that looks like more of a tax, frankly. You know, maybe we can say it now. Maybe we could call it an oil pollution tax or a transportation tax or something. But there are so many uses and needs in transportation for contributions from either this bill or some future transportation bill for the sorely needed investment in our existing transportation sector in transit, in the incentives for efficiency, whether it be, you know, vehicles or the transportation system efficiency itself, investments in smart growth and VMT, and as I mentioned, you know, our government's capacity to respond to future spills. Of course, having said that, it's obviously always difficult to get politicians to talk about anything that increases energy cost, especially in election year and especially right now with a recession. But I'm just hoping and frankly praying that the confluence of the needs that we're seeing right now on the oil spill, the climate, the transportation sector front, the energy efficiency front, creates an opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicki. It strikes me listening to Vicki and noting that a lot of my friends from the transportation community are here today, that as we conflate climate issues and energy issues and transportation issues, one of our barriers is language, that, you know, it's often very difficult to understand across sectors. I think Vicki was very clear, and things like allowances, what's the difference between an allowance and an allocation and an auction, and how do they all work together? It's very difficult for folks who are not within the climate community to understand that. So if you have any questions, don't feel about language or meaning. Don't feel shy about asking that question as well, because we're going to have to learn to speak each other's language if we're going to work together. So why don't we go to Darren now, who will give us the position of the Transportation for America Coalition on the Carrie Lieberman revenue allocations.
Thanks, David. And it's good to see so many familiar faces out there. I'm actually going to wear two hats. I'm going to be James Corliss, but I'm also going to be Darren Lovaas of NRDC and talk about some of the other transportation provisions that don't have to do with infrastructure that are in the bill, as well as progress that we've made in terms of policies affecting both the technology and fuels in terms of vehicles. First of all, just NRDC, who are we? One of the largest conservation organizations in the country, 1 million members across the country, offices across the country, and one in Beijing, which, as you might imagine, is overwhelmed almost on a daily basis in terms of the task they face dealing with environmental damage in China. Transportation for America is the largest, most diverse reform group out there pushing for a transportation reauthorization. It includes the American Public Health Association. It includes the National Association of Realtors and the National Association of City Transportation Officials, as well as different environmental groups and community groups, et cetera. And we think it's time that we have a modern transportation system that runs efficiently, is funded wisely, and provides Americans with more options in order to ensure we can get where we need to go and use less oil while doing so, and do so in ways that are safe and allow for an array of choices. We really think it's time for a modern transportation system that's suitable for the 21st century. And not to diverge too much from the topic today, which is, of course, the Carrie Lieberman bill, the most live proposal out there legislatively right now. But I just wanted to briefly talk about where T4A stands in terms of the reauthorization bill. We have a reform blueprint out there, the Route to Reform. I encourage you to take a look at it digest what's in there and consider whether or not it makes sense. It's got four large components. One, to develop a national transportation vision with objectives and accountability for meeting performance targets. The objectives are improved economic competitiveness, improved conditions and connectivity, greater energy efficiency and security, protection of the environment, safety, public health, and equitable access to transportation. So those are the big objectives that we think the transportation program should have. In order to achieve those, the current program, and we're not the only group that's saying this, a couple of government-sponsored commissions have said the same thing, and Chairman Oberstar's bill, the only actual proposal out there, would achieve this as well. The structure needs to be overhauled. Programs need to be consolidated into a set of priority programs, a geographically tiered multimodal access program, programs that are designed to complete the transportation system, so we actually have a national transportation system with a variety of options for people. And finally, there need to be innovation incentives provided for states and localities to move ahead and show us the way as the laboratories that they can be in terms of making progress on transportation. Third, agencies and decision-making needs to be reformed in order to fit this structure and the objectives. And last but not least, the big question is how to fund the program. And we are in favor, if need be, of increasing the gas tax. We are in favor of shifting to a VMT fee. We are in favor of cobbling together alternatives like more road pricing and congestion pricing and borrowing through constructs like an infrastructure bank in order to make ends meet. And we are in favor of a very large program, $500 billion program over 6 years. So, and we are aggressively pushing for an expanded program with these energy and environmental and social goals. So, shifting to another debate where, frankly, we've made more progress, with energy and climate, we passed an energy bill in 2005. We did another one in 2007. And thanks to those bills and the administration's effective use of the tools provided by those bills, we're making good progress in putting policy on the books that will save oil and reduce heat-trapping emissions. Raising performance standards for vehicles is a big part of that, and the administration is now working on performance standards for heavy-duty vehicles. As you probably know, they've announced a national program for performance standards for light-duty vehicles, and they're working on a volumetric standard for fuels. All of that will add up to a savings of about 3.5 million barrels a day by 2030, or about 20% of projected consumption. We're making good progress when it comes to vehicle technology and fuels, and that'll save about 570 million metric tons per year of carbon dioxide emissions as well. So we're now sitting here with another big energy and climate bill, the latest iteration of which is the Kerry-Lieberman bill, which would build on this progress. And the current bill includes not just the revenue-generating mechanism that's the topic of this forum, but a set of investments that would help to save oil and reduce emissions. There's a program in there for plug-in electric vehicle deployment. Would require DOT to develop a national plan for infrastructure to support pluggable electric vehicle charging and to conduct pluggable electric vehicle pilot projects across the country in urban and rural locations. Interestingly, a coalition called the Electrification Coalition has a much more aggressive, robust plan that they released in the form of a bill co-sponsored by Senators Alexander, Dorgan, and Merkley last week, and they want five times as much funding as currently is in the bill in order to move forward aggressively with an electrification agenda. So there's a lot of interest in electrification of vehicles in order to reduce oil consumption and emissions. There is money in the bill to retool auto plants, grants to automakers and suppliers to re-equip factories to produce qualifying cleaner technologies. That builds on a similar provision in the 2007 energy bill. There are incentives for natural gas-powered vehicles. You might be familiar with some of these provisions. They're backed by a multi-billionaire named T. Boone Pickens, and they provide various consumer and manufacturer incentives for shifting to natural gas-powered vehicles, especially in the heavy-duty and medium-duty portion of the vehicle fleet. In addition to that, of course, the topic we're covering here is transportation efficiency and transit. The bill provides $6.25 billion per annum starting in 2013. Oh.
Yes.
2012 would have been last year. So that's right. We've been debating this bill for a little more than a year. So starting in 2013, this is more, a lot more than what's in the House proposal, the Waxman-Markey proposal. It's a lot more than what was in the Kerry-Boxer bill, the previous iteration, last year's iteration of the climate bill. Some of that money would go to the Highway Trust Fund, so long as certain planning standards and performance standards are met for its use. Some of the money would go to Tiger Transportation Grants, and some of the money would go to clean tea projects and planning that's part of implementing those projects, and Vicky talked about that. So that's another transportation piece to this bill. So we have this proposal on the table. It's got vehicle fuel and infrastructure components. There's interest in more robust investment provisions, especially focusing on oil savings. The bill certainly has, thanks part to the Gulf spill, has risen to the top of the administration's agenda. The president, in fact, said a couple days ago that he'll make the case for a clean energy future whenever he can, and will work with anyone from either party to get this done. And then he said, but we will get this done. The next generation will not be held hostage to energy sources from the last century. So he's clear. He wants to push for a bill And he said over the next few months. So this year is what a lot of us are hoping will be the case, that a bill could come to the president's desk. If not, we'd like something to come to the president's desk soon thereafter. So we can build on the 2005 and 2007 energy bills. And actually, the bill could use some more oil-saving provisions, including ones that deal with electrification, for example. The Gulf oil spill has really, really focused people, again, on the oil issue and just what a problem our oil addiction is for the country. And just to give people an idea of the scale of the challenge, which you may or may not be, of which you may or may not be aware, right now, the Gulf spill, at least according to the most recent high end of the range that I've seen, is spewing 19,000 barrels per day worth of oil in the Gulf. So it's this geyser, I think the Post called it in today's paper. That seems like a lot of oil. Each barrel contains 42 gallons approximately. So that is a lot of oil, but we consume on a daily basis in this country more than 1,000 times that much oil. This is a huge, huge challenge we face, transitioning away from this resource, and it has to do with our transportation sector. You can't get beyond that. Transportation accounts for about 70% of our oil consumption and is about 95% dependent on this resource. So for those reasons, we think that this bill is going to move forward, that the president will keep pushing it, and we hope there will be more oil savings provisions included in it and that it will get enacted soon and actually help us to end our oil addiction in the coming decades. So, thanks.
Thank you, Darren. It's interesting that not only do we face competition for revenues from outside the transportation sector, but also even within the transportation sector. And just a quick question. You said the Electrification Coalition wants five times as much money to get. Is that actual cash or is that tax preferences or tax credits?
It's a combination. It's five times as much financing. I forget exactly how it breaks down in terms of the mechanisms. I should note it's also in a shorter period of time. I mean, they have an aggressive program to electrify a greater and greater percentage of our vehicle miles traveled. And so their agenda is pretty aggressive. That's right.
Okay, thanks. And finally, and last but not least, John Horsley from ASHTO will give remarks about their view on the allocation of these transportation-related revenues.
Okay. Thank you, David. It's good to be here. Good to be here with Vicki and Darren. Colin, I want you to tell James I'm disappointed that as soon as he heard that I was going to be on the program, he left town. But we'll deal with that later. Janet Oakley is here. Janet is our policy director and supervises our Center for Environmental Excellence that the 50 state DOTs have put together to guide the work that we do in environmental policy. And then Caroline Paulson is in the back, and she works for Janet and Shannon Eggleston, and Caroline's our specialist on climate change. We have a state pooled fund. About 3 years ago, the states recognized that we've got to get smart fast in this area on behalf of the state DOTs who work for governors and state legislators, because there's no question that the transportation sector and state DOTs recognize we've got to do our part to help achieve national goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We embrace our responsibility to achieve the 80% reduction goal. So in the context of this discussion, there are two bits of legislation that are crucial to state DOTs, governors, and state legislators right now. We are accountable to state governors and legislators to be their agents on transportation, and in turn, ASHTO, who represents the 50 state DOTs, and that for the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, we are accountable to our members. And unlike NRDC or T for America, which focuses specially on environmental policy, climate change policy, we're responsible for delivering a transportation system the entire nation depends on. So we have to see this in a much broader context. So the two bits of legislation that both of which are important to us right now are, number one, a transportation bill, a surface transportation bill that continues to fund the Federal Aid Highway Program and the Federal Aid Transit Program. And eventually we're also going to add to that a high-speed rail program. But so that is paramount. That program expired October 1st last year. We're in the midst of an extension, and the jury's out as to how we're going to do on getting a bill passed that's going to sustain the program. But that's job one, is sustaining. About half of the capital for highways and transit in this country comes from the federal level. So it's not a minor challenge. It's a major challenge to sustain that essential component of how we provide mobility for the country. The other legislation that we'd love to see passed in the right form is climate change legislation. We recognize that transportation generates about 70% of greenhouse gas emissions. The highway sector the percentage, the breakdown I've seen, service transportation about 29%, highways about 16.5%. No, it's not 29. It's 29% of all emissions is transportation, and then service transportation about 16.5%. So we got to do what we got to do to help achieve the greenhouse gas reduction goals. So David's question to me, is Carrie Lieberman the answer? Our answer to that was, in its current form, no. Because in its current form, and 27 other national organizations joined in a letter, May 18th letter, to Senators Kerry and Lieberman, saying politely but forcefully, your bill doesn't do what is acceptable to the transportation community. Talk with us, work with us, see what we can do to improve it. But the effect of the bill as written would be to preempt the funding for the highway program. The highway program since the 50s has been 90% dependent on transportation fuel taxes. Both of the national commissions that studied this issue, and Susan Binder here, who staffed the first commission, said the only way forward for the next 12 years is the fuel tax. The effect of the Kerry Lieberman legislation, if passed in its current form, would preempt the opportunity or the possibility of enacting an increase in fuel taxes, which would slam the door on passage of a transportation bill. So 27 national organizations, we on behalf of the states, but the American Public Transportation Association on behalf of the transit authorities all over the country, and 26 other national organizations who care about transportation said no. This bill doesn't cut it because it would preempt other vital legislation that's vital to the country. And let me put a little bit more background on what we're talking about here. In the current highway and transit program, the highway program is currently being funded at $43 billion. The transit program is being funded around $11 billion. So we're spending, under the current regimen, $54 billion a year on service transportation. Revenues flowing into the Highway Trust Fund are coming in around $36, $37 billion. So the same 12-cent floor that is included in Kerry Lieberman is exactly the 12-cent that we need just to sustain the current program. Now, what Darren mentioned is T for America, ASHTO, Chairman Oberstar, wants to see the program grow from about $286 today to about $500 billion over the next six-year cycle. So that means you're going to need more than the 12-cent floor. You're going to need that plus 25, 30, 40 cents. It's not clear right now how much we'll need to achieve the $500 billion package that Chairman Oberstar has put forward. We haven't heard similar numbers, but I'll bet you the Senate, should they get there, between the Banking Committee and Environment Public Works, wants a similar scale program. So every dime, or virtually every dime that you see that the Kerry Lieberman bill would produce, because what we're seeing is somewhere between 19.5 and 40.6 billion is the range of dollars initially, and then it goes up about 3% over time. Every dime that would be generated there would also be required to fund their transportation bill. If Carrie Lieberman goes first, it sucks the oxygen out of the room and preempts the possibility of passing a transportation bill. So with that as context, 28 national organizations wrote them saying no. Our position right now, and I think we'll stand firm to that, is if Carrie Lieberman goes forward and can channel the resources that it generates from surface transportation fuels, the diesel, gasoline, ethanol, you name all the transportation fuels that are burned in surface transportation, if that is channeled into the Highway Trust Fund, every dime, then we will be the strongest allies to passage of this legislation. If they decide to go the current approach, which is 6.25, and only 2.5 of that, you can see the contrast. If cash flow right now, we're 17 short or 18 billion short of just sustaining the current program, no growth, and the best they can come up with is 2.5, and the overall bill preempts funding the program, we're going to have to say no. And we will do everything we can to make sure this bill does not preempt funding of the transportation bill. So that's with the focus on the transportation bill. Now let's move to the Carrie Lieberman climate change bill in itself. What does it do for transportation? We would entertain discussion with T for America, with NRDC, the Carnegie Endowment, even the Georgetown Center, about, you know,
wackos.
There you go. What do you do with if revenues do flow in for climate change purposes? You know, there's all sorts of good things that are proposed to be. The Tiger Grant program, the clean T-type objectives, and even the 2.5 that's there for the Highway Trust Fund. There's good things that could result from climate change generated revenues if we've taken care of funding the highway program, the transit program, and eventually we're trying to have a long-term source of funding for the high-speed rail program. All those we've got to take care of. Then let's talk about if there's more revenue on the table, how best to spend it, because we are committed to doing what states and cities and counties, MPOs, transit authorities all can do together to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So let me take you through some of the things that we think are going to be part of the solution. And then the final thing I want to touch on, Vicki raised, is there's no money on the table that we have seen for adaptation. Janet, Vicki, and many others may have been to a White House meeting a week ago on what is going to happen to the surface transportation system once the effects of climate change kick in, the destruction of the tundra in Alaska and across Canada, and that effect on those northern systems, the coastal systems, inundation, and the right sizing and change to how we build culverts and bridges. It's a massive, massive investment that it's going to take to adapt our current infrastructure to what we see coming in the future. But what do we think needs to be done, and how can we join forces to get it done? We want to double transit ridership in the next 20 years and double it again, so quadruple it in the next 40 years. We think that is an essential part of the solution. Land use planning and transportation. We rarely do communities talk to states or even to their transit agents or their transportation agencies at the local level. We're advancing a development pattern in this country that's not sustainable, and we need to improve that. We're proposing $100 million a year out of the transportation bill to fund a land use transportation dialogue, demonstration projects, you name it. We know that this is an area that we've got to work on together. More bicycle pedestrian work. We think the enhancement program, which has been the bread and butter of Rails to Trails and other vital national organizations, we want to see that sustained. And if we can double funding for the program, we'll double funding for bike and ped improvements. We want $3 billion a year dedicated to an operational program that can reduce congestion, smooth flow through advanced technology and better transportation system management. We want half of the environmental program, about 1.7 a year, to be dedicated, very similar to the 1.85 that's proposed here, for climate change-related investments that states, cities, and counties can implement. in the bill and in the House bill, there's going to be a mandate, and we think it's inevitable, it's coming, that states, cities, and counties through their MPOs are going to have to chart a course of how, what are we going to do through what we manage and have control over to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The bill calls for setting targets and strategies to achieve the targets. We think that is a reasonable approach. What does concern us is the balance of power between US DOT and EPA in that mix, because EPA's mandate is protect the environment, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Rarely does EPA balance that with what are we going to do to sustain a healthy national economy and mobility. DOT's mission is to sustain mobility consistent with environmental policy, and we want to make sure that there is a balanced approach between the mission to protect the environment and reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the same time that you balance sustaining a strong national economy and mobility. Unless DOT is given a co-equal status with EPA, we're afraid that decisions will be made that in the long term are not sustainable, not from the perspective of the environment, but from the perspective of the economy. And we think that that is important. So the long and the short of it, right now, AASHTO, APTA, and a broad array of organizations whose focus is transportation are telling Senator Lieberman and Senator Kerry, this bill doesn't cut it as written. But if they and we and others can come to an agreement on how to make it possible to meet the basic transportation needs of the country and move forward on climate change legislation that makes sense, then we'll be their best ally. Until that, we're going to have to say, no, this bill as written doesn't work for us or the states or the cities or the county or the economy, and we're going to have to push back. If we can reach an accommodation, then we'll be the best allies and add to the army that sees the need for climate change legislation. Done.
Thank you, John. Well done, and everybody kept to their time limit. That's terrific. So we have about a half an hour for questions. Now, we do have, this is being recorded. We're going to have a transcript produced. So we have some microphones in the back, I believe, don't we? Alex from Carnegie here has a microphone. So if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand and identify yourself, and Alex will give you the microphone. I'll take the right of the moderator to ask the first question. I thank the panelists again for their very clear presentations. And it does seem, and I think in hearing the discussion back and forth between both the transportation bill and the climate bill, that what it comes down to is that we're kind of stuck here in this death grip where the reform community can cancel or stop the transportation bill if they don't get the reforms they want. And the transportation community can stop the climate bill if they don't get the revenues they want out of the climate bill. So, John, I've heard you say in the past that, you know, 80% of what T4 America wants, you know, you're fine with, your organization is fine with. Is there a way to come to some sort of conclusion so it's a double win rather than a double loss? I was intrigued by Vicky's description of the Edison Electric Institute negotiating a deal between the various utilities and energy organizations on the climate bill side. And when they came to an agreement, they got exactly what they wanted. Once they had the agreement, they just put it into the bill. Is such a possible ecumenical arrangement possible, and which would both finance the transportation bill and provide a dream team support for the climate bill?
Well, I think the answer would be potentially yes.
Is it just a revenue issue for you, or is it also a structural issue?
It is primarily a revenue issue, but when it comes to the planning provision and the strategies contained in the bill, there's also some state concern. But I would say If we can resolve our differences over preemption of the essential revenue that's needed for the highway and transit program, then a lot of the other problems can be sufficiently negotiated. And let me just say in passing that you started your presentation, Darren, outlining this marvelous reform proposal that you and T for America are for. I'm proud of the fact that our states, from our meeting in Portland in 2006 and again in Hartford in 2008, came up with a very reform-minded approach that embraced many of the recommendations of the first Surface Transportation Policy and Revenue Study Commission. Many of the recommendations there were in not that far off of what Chairman Oberstar has recommended in terms of going to a performance-based system accountable for results that focuses on objectives of genuine national interest. Much of the structure of what Oberstar is trying to achieve in the House bill either echoed the first commission or echoed our proposal. So we are firmly on record in favor of a reform approach. And many of those reforms are consistent with what the T for America is advanced.
Okay.
So just very quickly, in terms of your question, I'm not sure how much further, if any further, this bill can go in terms of investments in infrastructure without undermining the overall purpose of the program. And realize this is an energy independence and climate change bill. This is a huge bill aimed at creating a clean energy economy in the coming decades in the United States. It builds on equally, well, actually, it's even bigger, but it builds on big bills, as I said, from 05 and 07. The transportation provisions, important to everyone in this room, including yours truly, are significant and substantial, and they are one piece in a very large structure. And consequently, there's a lot of pieces to this, and the whole thing holds together with an integrity that will allow it to achieve the emission reductions we need by 2050, will allow it to squeeze oil imports as much as we'd like to in the coming decades. And I don't think there's a lot of wiggle room in terms of changing it without undermining the energy independent and climate change goals, which I think a lot of us are agreed on need to be achieved by the nation. On a separate note, I just want to take issue with something that John said about this bill potentially taking the oxygen out of the room in terms of a gas tax increase. There is no oxygen in the room. The last time we increased the gas tax was in 1993, and it was for deficit reduction purposes. Before that, we did it in 1990, and it was for deficit reduction purposes. The last time a gas tax increase was aimed specifically at benefiting the transportation program, and it took a mighty effort, was in 1982, as I'm sure you well know. And consequently, it's been 30 years. And what that says to me is that the Policy and Revenue Commission, the Infrastructure Financing Commission, the Bipartisan Policy Center, Transportation for America, all these groups out there pushing for reform are onto something. We need a new product because we're just not making a sale with policymakers or the public about more investment in this program. And it's been decades, frankly, since we've been able to make that sale. So.
Susan?
I guess I'd like to...
Do we identify yourself?
Susan Binder, Cambridge Systematics. I guess I want to push this question just a little bit further in order to understand positionally where some of that middle ground is. Let's say for the sake of argument that a transportation bill went first and there was... you said, John, 25-cent increase, it would be something in that order in order to increase the scale, scope of investment up to where needs might be. So, again, there's lots of debate about what that number would be, but big. Darren, what would be the impact, as you see it, on the carbon use? How sufficient would that be to make the changes to through the market, as opposed to through more direct mandates? What would be missing if you? What else would you have to do in order to meet the kind of targets you're talking about? Or would that shake up the system enough that we'd make huge progress and we could have our cake and eat it too? That's what I'm trying to test.
Well, in terms of passing a much bigger transportation bill, because of the, as we all know, the vast investments that are needed out there in the system to deal with the deferred maintenance program, which I know you know about, and to deal with the mobility challenges, especially in metropolitan areas that we face, et cetera, to address things like the administration's intercity rail program. And I'm sticking with the transportation bill. I think you could do a big bill with a revenue a gas tax increase combined with an infrastructure bank, a gas tax increase combined with an infrastructure bank, and increased tolling and use of congestion pricing and those kind of road pricing tools, in order to lift it to that level and achieve measurable oil savings and greenhouse gas emission reductions, and complement a climate bill. And I think if you can go to the nation and say, we're going to do a transportation bill, and guess what? It's not going to be the usual pork barrel, earmark, laden program. It's going to help us meet national goals that we all feel we urgently need to meet, including energy independence, which a lot of people are focused on now. In order to do that, we're going to need more investment. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I really see these two as complements, and I don't see them as mutually exclusive. I think we're going to get more than one bite at the apple, basically, in terms of addressing the oil challenge, which means the transportation challenge we have in this country. So.
Let me agree with Darren's reflection on history of how it was that we passed the last two fuel tax increases. If you go back to 91, when George Bush Sr. said, read my lips, no new taxes, and then signed a nickel fuel tax increase, half of it went for transportation, half of it went for deficit reduction. About 8 years later, it all went entirely for transportation. Then when Bill Clinton came into office, he proposed an 8% BTU tax and then ultimately settled for a 4.3-cent fuel tax increase. All of that went for a deficit reduction for, I think, about 5 years. And then Senator Graham of Texas bravely recommended putting it into transportation because the Clinton-Gore folks had balanced the budget and looked and were on track for a surplus. So that was the combination of interests. It took deficit reduction and transportation interests to jointly have the wherewithal to convince Congress to increase taxes. You're absolutely right. There's no climate right now for raising taxes. I think the unemployment numbers today are going to be around 9.8%. Until we come out of this recession, you won't see a fuel tax increase or much any tax increase. But the same thing applies to the dynamics of climate change legislation that depends on imposing, and I've been told I can't use the word tax. Mm-hmm. I'm not supposed to. You use fee. I'm not supposed
we're
to,
not supposed
to
use fee. Either, I've been told.
Is some adjustment mechanism allowance. We got to come up with a better vocabulary to describe this bill without offending the two sponsors. But the long and the short of it, the effect is going to be to jack up the cost to the American people by the equivalent of a 12. You know, the floor is 12 cent. A fuel tax increase, the ceiling is about a 40 cent fuel tax increase that was consistent with what the first commission recommended. So we're looking for friends, Darren. And we may very well see a community of interest with the climate change world in order to get what both interests need. I do not believe you can get 60 votes in the Senate or even 51 votes in the Senate right now. And there are mountain state interests and southern state interests represented by Democrats who might potentially vote ultimately for this legislation if they could be assured the needs of their state would be met for both transportation and climate. But there it's going to be very difficult for the sponsors of this bill to get the majority they need unless parts of the country that don't live and breathe climate change can be convinced they benefit.
In the back.
Hi, Jeff Brown with Pew Charitable Trusts. Okay, so what I'm hearing is a transportation bill won't happen with a gas tax, and a global warming bill won't happen if it has a gas tax in it. I spend my life counting votes. There's 12 weeks left in this session, if that, with a Supreme Court nominee tossed in. I think what you're suggesting is pretty powerful. It would mean sort of reframing the debate completely, that the transportation bill carries the global warming part. Yes, the transportation bill carries the global warming part of the Kerry-Lieberman bill, essentially. And that because of the status we have right now, Kerry-Lieberman has to be sort of become a climate light bill. Do any of you want to address that?
I mean, I guess that's what I was getting at earlier, Jeff. I mean, I wonder if there's not some scenario, given the limited time and given that there seems to be some people who want to be regulated in the form of the electric utility sector, if they know they get a fair allocation or to them, a generous allocation, then that might change in the future. And so can we think about this as maybe a phased approach where that sector goes first in the limited amount of time, and then part of the transportation bill discussions next year, and it will be after this election, could hopefully include a lot of these elements that we're talking about, the price signal, which I would hope, we can revisit in the wake of this bill. Now, you know, I think this bill can work in a different way where people would say, yeah, you know, tax the fuels because we want to sort of, you know, be more efficient, but give the money back to the people or put the money in some kind of, you know, fund so that we've got the technology to fix this if this ever happens again, which we obviously don't, or invest in alternatives. And I really could see a scenario where the future tax that we're able to get might even have less in a way for some of the things that we're talking about today. So I think there's some risk in waiting and putting our hopes in that basket. But I do think that the idea of some kind of sector-by-sector approach might gain some traction that we're not otherwise getting on a comprehensive energy and climate bill. It's been a difficult sell for a long time, and it's very difficult in what we see before us right now, I think. I guess my question to John and Darren, who know more about what's possible in the transportation bill context, and David too, is could the transportation bill be even a home for something like a low-carbon fuel standard in addition to the price signal and some of the planning opportunities that we're talking about here, the transportation efficiency provisions? I mean, could the transportation bill look very different in that way as well?
Vicki, I think you're getting into committee jurisdiction. That's an even more inviolate role than who does what to whom.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get those committees to talk to each other, perhaps. But I suspect you'd have to have tandem legislation rather than expect EPW or commerce or banking to get into that stuff and invade the turf of energy and some of the other. Now EPW does have the lead on this, so that might be possible, but I don't think the House jurisdiction is the same. So I think that would be a limiting factor. But anything's possible. We are stalled and we're going nowhere. We need friends. Either we're going to have to link our future to deficit reduction like we did the last two times, mm-hmm. or climate. We're open to who wants to be our friend. But I also firmly believe that the swing votes that are crucial to the passage of this legislation are going to have to satisfy the interests of states who don't necessarily embrace climate change as avidly as the prime sponsors of this bill. Massachusetts, Connecticut, and the West Coast love this stuff. but they're the heartland of the country. You got to struggle.
Stephanie, I think you had your hand up first.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Potts from Smart Growth America. My question is primarily for John. It seems like one thing the oil spill has done is garner some political will for raising fees for dealing with spills and cleanup. And I was wondering if AASHTO has a position on the increase in fees for those purposes in the bill that was just passed out of the House.
I'm not acquainted with the bill, and I don't think we have positions on spills. We think it's terrible, and gosh, those pictures in the Post this morning, they're going to rivet everyone's attention nationally that something's got to be done. But what, again, the longer-term dynamic of climate change, what Vicky brought up and what many of our members are now aware of, you're going to see dramatic impacts on the nation's transportation system from the effects of rising temperatures and climate change. Heavier precipitation events, tidal inundation, permafrost, the dynamics that are facing our transportation system are going to present a massive adaptation bill, not as dramatic as seeing the brown pelican decimated with the oil load, but eventually we're going to have to do everything we can to mitigate against that, mm-hmm. but a lot of it's coming inevitably and we're going to have to adjust. So it's a tandem issue, but I'm not acquainted with the House legislation.
Stephanie, are you talking about the tax bill?
Yeah.
And how much was the increase in the oil pollution tax?
I'm not super familiar with it, but I think it was like 8 cents to 35 cents.
Yeah, I think it was about that. I mean, if I can reframe your question.
Per barrel.
The question, John, I think, if reframed is, do you view that increase, or that assessment, that tax assessment, pollution tax assessment, as competitive with your ability? Because that's eventually is going to be translated into a price on the pump, right? So even though 35 cents a barrel, I think, turns out to be about 1 cent or 2 cent per gallon. And do you view that as competitive?
We would have to study that, but I'll tell you one thing I don't want to get in the way of is folks solving the problem facing the Gulf. And I'll bet you our members would embrace something that's essential. I suspect that what folks would just as soon do is put the bill with strong enforcement on BP.
So, I mean, I'm going to have to ask my question then. Well, what about not 35 cents? What about $8 a barrel, which would translate into about 45 cents a gallon? That would generate about $32 billion a year. You could have half of that go to pollution cleanup, which is going to probably what we need for the next 20 years. $15 billion a year, if you think of Katrina as any example in terms of public funds. And the rest of it goes to transportation and, you know, National Infrastructure Bank and all these good things, and you could bond against it. But maybe a pollution tax, a very big pollution tax, which everybody would support, at the top upstream, which applies to everything. You know, you might have 42 gallons in an oil barrel, but you know, that's kerosene, that's asphalt, that's everything else, too. I don't know how much would come in the gas tax. Is that possible?
Well, some of our initial public opinion research shows that it looks like the Gulf spill is a bit of a game changer in terms of public perception about how aggressive we should be in moving away from oil. It would be useful to test whether or not that applies to an oil pollution fee or an oil freedom fee or something akin to that. That would help to benefit the transportation program and see if there's public resonance out there. Whether or not there is, one of the longer-term efforts I think we all need to engage in is a rescue of the gas tax's reputation and taking the taint off of this revenue-generating mechanism, which some other public opinion research we've done shows polls even worse than incumbents do right now, so which is pretty bad. It is a badly poisoned well in terms of generating revenue for the transportation program. We have come a long way since the user fee terminology of the early 80s, and it is a problem. And it would be useful to see if the Gulf spill might have altered the context enough that people would be more receptive if you could point to a set of purposes that mm-hmm. makes sense in terms of addressing the energy independence issue that are tied to such a fee. So
let me make two comments. Number one, let's talk on the first issue, because we embrace the need for climate change legislation that works and can achieve the greenhouse gas reduction goals that the president has outlined and others have as well. And it's absolutely essential that we fund on an ongoing basis a viable transit and highway federal aid program. So those are a starting point. But let me embrace one other idea that NRDC is for. I don't know where T for America is for, but we think it is an absolutely essential component of how we're going to get to the 80% reduction goal, and that is electrification mm-hmm. of vehicles. Dan Sperling wrote a book, 2 Billion Cars, and it's coming. I was led a delegation to India last November, and we're regularly in contact with the Chinese. The amount of cars being purchased in India and China and the rest of the world is massive, and that second billion is coming fast. It's going to offset any gain we make through prudent national policy and CAFE, VMT reduction, et cetera. It's going to be swamp. Unless we can accelerate the introduction and massive distribution of electric fueled vehicles rather than petroleum fueled vehicles, we aren't going to get there. So we fully embrace that strategy, and we're pleased that the bill addresses some ways, and if there are senators that want to accelerate it five times, we're probably for that, because it's got to be part of the solution.
I agree with a caveat that this is going to be something where we're going to need silver buckshot as opposed to silver bullets. And to mix metaphors, I've learned that the hard way by watching the bloom come off the rose with hydrogen and then with ethanol. And I'm just waiting for the fatal flaw to be identified for plug-in vehicles. So which points to the need for an array of strategies, mm-hmm. including better conventional technology, a set of alternative liquids, and electrification, as well as doing something about travel activity, so which is what these travel efficiency provisions are aimed at. So,
Alan.
Tyler Frisbee from Congressman Blumenauer's office, and I work for one of the few members of Congress who has no problem advocating for a gas tax anytime, anywhere, mm-hmm. in his sleep.
You're from Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little different out there. But I think I have a longer-term question, which is, we see a lot of discussion about increasing the gas tax, Mr. DeFazio's suggestion of taxing oil barrels and trading, but the long term, especially when we're looking at this in terms of a climate change bill, which whether it happens this year, which my boss certainly believes that it will and hopes that it will, or whether it's next year or the year after, it's happening soon. And we're going to see, hopefully, a significant decrease in the amount of oil consumption in the country. So for the long term, funding our transportation system and other parts of our emissions reduction plan through an oil tax or a gas tax isn't going to work 20 years out, maybe even 15 years out, which to me, as folks who care about transportation, infrastructure funding, and who also care about the environment and climate change issues, we need to be thinking now about how else do we fund this, because we need to start putting those funding mechanisms in place and figuring out how to message it, how to talk about it, how it's going to work, and how it changes our transportation system, because when we have some other mechanism putting in money, it is going to change the game a little bit. I would love to hear your thoughts on what that looks like, where we should be looking, and kind of your organization's general stance on those.
Do I want to go first? Good tactic. No, I'll go. And I'll put on James's hat.
Big sales.
What? I'll put on James's hat briefly. Transportation for America. If you look in the Route to Reform blueprint, you'll see there's an endorsement of a gas tax increase if needed to achieve the bigger bill level. And a endorsement also of an infrastructure bank to take advantage of the ability to finance off of existing capital and new capital to be generated reliably. And there is mention of the VMT fee and a transition from a tolling of roads, so road pricing that's done in a patchwork way across the country, eventually to universal tolling, essentially, to a VMT fee of some sort. That's the one big idea I've seen out there that a lot of people are talking about is the VMT fee. And I know there was a pilot program in Oregon very cleverly done through the gas pump so that it didn't involve extra infrastructure for people to deal with and therefore was very successful with the people who tried it. I think Oregon already covers all truck traffic through the state through universal tolling. So Oregon is, just like you were the first state to do the gas tax, you're looking ahead to what could be next in the coming decades. And that's key. It would take decades, and it's not a surefire. It's not a slam dunk, basically. So, which means you have to think about what else you might look at. And the only other option, I think, is to look at the general fund. And for better or for worse, that's where the program is drifting de facto, with $35 billion worth of borrowing to keep the trust fund solvent just since 2008, money from the stimulus bill injected in as well. It's already drifting towards a greater and greater reliance on the general fund. Whether or not that's the right way to go, that is another alternative, and that's where the drift is taking it currently. Regardless, it's something we do need to figure out. This dawned on me when I looked at not just Department of Energy's projections and saw that, remarkably, thanks partly to increased efficiency and increased use of ethanol in transportation, oil consumption, the curves are going down slightly out to 2030, which is really strange to see in the last couple of annual energy outlooks that that's the case. And if you doubt that that's likely, the Cambridge Energy Research Associates, an industry-funded firm, agrees. ExxonMobil agrees. As a friend of mine who used to do that kind of outlook for ExxonMobil put it, its efficiency as far as the eye can see. This is how much of a difference the 2007 energy bill and the new national vehicle program are making. And it creates a good problem, frankly. We have a projected ramping down of gasoline consumption, which I think everyone agrees is a worthy national goal, but it's a problem for the transportation sector and how to finance this program. So, sorry, that was a long answer, but that's...
Well, the first thing I want to do is clone the Oregon delegation. Earl Blumenauer has been the most articulate voice for how to fund the future transportation bill, followed only by Peter DeFazio. Every day these two keep articulating good ideas, and then Ron Wyden, working with us, got the Build America Bonds, including the stimulus bill, which is, I think, capitalizing $100 billion in infrastructure improvements around the country right now. So we need more Oregon folks, leaders like Earl Blumenauer, Peter DeFazio, and Ron Wyden. We firmly buy into the fact that we're going to have a transition. The first national commission said about 12 years out. The second commission said about 12 years out. It's in that window, because when you look at the 2016 CAFE transition, when we're at the fleet, the new cars are at 35 miles per gallon, and then I'll bet you there's a next CAFE that has an even more stringent mandate. And the market itself, I think as prices go up, the market itself is going to see more fuel-efficient vehicles. The ability to sustain the program with a cents per gallon basis is just going to fade, and we're going to need to replace it with another surrogate for measuring use. The controversy with the Oregon study and several others is, can you do it at the pump, which is in tax hundreds of millions of transactions? It's going to be very expensive. So we're not sure that mechanism that Oregon pioneered would work, but a surrogate for use has got to be found that measures distance traveled, use of the system. There are many options that are being explored, but we think we're going to have to jump on this and explore it sooner than later, because I don't think you'll have the luxury of waiting to 2020. I think we're going to have to accelerate the introduction of some alternatives. And it may be that we need to get some alternatives because this toxic atmosphere around the field tax doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Right now, it can't go anywhere because of the economy, but that may not turn the day, because right now we've seen the same polling you have.
One of the things I learned from, you know, palling around with the transport people, like David said, we also really have to learn each other's language, and about the bills, that the fact that the government gives less for operating expenses and more for capital really affects transit adversely, because so much of that expense is from the drivers and the operating safely of things like Metro. We see the fare increases, which might have an effect on ridership that's negative at the same time that we're trying to do something. So I think those kind of, you know, questions about how do you spend the formulas and how do you allow people to spend the federal money that there is, I think could be an important contributor. And the other thing, while I'm talking about federal subsidies, is the oil subsidies and fare revenues back to the governments, both the federal government in the form of royalties and the state governments, that I think hopefully will come out of this. Again, you know, the tragedy in the Gulf. I think that people are going to start to take a hard look at how much has been given away, and then that could presumably, if some of those subsidies are taken away, it would both obviously have more of a pass-through on the prices, which might abate driving, but also would allow more in the federal coffers to go for these other purposes.
It's time for one more question. Alan's had his hand up since the beginning.
Alan Greenberg, Federal Highways. Thank you. Going back to the core dispute about the revenue and from Carrie Lieberman and where it might go, it strikes me that the real question is some of it's going back to the public in one form or another, and so it seems that that part of the equation might have to be changed to put the revenue back into the trust fund. It's going back either in terms of rebates or in deficit reduction, at least a reasonable part of it. And so perhaps that's the right equation. Perhaps it should go into transportation and less should go toward those other purposes. But it's not like, at least the way I read it, that the money's all going somewhere else. It seems that it's going back to the public. My second question is related to pricing incentives, which is a big part of this as well. It seems that there are incentives that are missing that from a size standpoint can dwarf the incentives already in the bill. The two that come to mind are something called parking cash out, where we allow people to just pay for employers to just pay for parking, which 99% of employees do. We also allow them to pay for transit, but my understanding is only about 5% of employers do that. And so cash out would essentially require that for the tax benefits of a free parking space, you'd have to offer cash in lieu of that. And the study suggested 12% reduction in driving resulting from that. The second one is pay-as-you-drive insurance. That would convert an insurance cost about 8 cents a mile, much larger, again, than just the financial incentives contained in this bill. And they seem to, they don't solve the revenue side of it, except perhaps the insurance part could partially, because the same system that allows mileage insurance could also allow VMT pricing. But I don't see anything, I mean, those seem to be larger financial mechanisms, and they don't appear to be in this bill, and I'm wondering if anyone had any comment on those two issues. Thank you.
At least with pay-by-the-mile insurance, that the more I've looked at that over the years, the more that seems like a no-brainer and something that could be a transition to a VMT fee. I think you're absolutely right. I think probably the only reason it's not in the bill is that the sponsors aren't that familiar with the policy and probably didn't see how it fit into a larger energy and climate bill. The same probably applies to parking cash out, and both of those would provide energy savings and emission reductions that can be quantified. So if not in this bill, through amendment or by the sponsors through manager's amendment, there should be policy to encourage both of those, to provide incentives for both of those. Agree with that 100%. The first issue you brought up is exactly right, and this is the challenge with the bill. It is a very carefully constructed bill. Investments are allocated towards specific purposes to hold consumers whole and to achieve emission reductions and to transition to a clean energy economy, and it's a zero-sum game. And it's a zero-sum game that has already been very tightly and robustly debated. And so I'll repeat what I said earlier. I don't know how much room there is for further wiggling beyond the, you know, this is a jump from what was in Waxman-Markey, and it's a jump from what was in Kerry Boxer for transportation infrastructure. And given the zero-sum nature of the game, I'm not sure there's room for further movement if the bill is to hold together and achieve its ends, which are energy independence and addressing climate change.
Let me use a terrible mixed metaphor. Transportation is being treated like a stepchild on this bill, and transportation revenues are being used as a cash cow. And if you look at the 2020 anticipated revenue, it could be as high as $57 billion generated from transportation fuels. And then the proposed rate of return to transportation is $6.2 billion. And the effect of that, as we said, would preempt funding of vital transportation services in the country. So the people who have been at the table negotiating this zero-sum game haven't included transportation. And I think what we're going to try to do is help senators from swing states understand that can't continue and help the bill sponsors understand they can't pass a bill without the senators whose interests may not have been satisfied. So I don't think the bill as structured can pass. Whether we can help it pass it, that's still the jury's out on that one. But right now, I don't see this bill succeeding as written because of the things we discussed. Now, getting back to your question on pricing and some of the other public policy issues, when we are called for in this bill to chart targets and strategies, I think pricing will be one of the key elements that are included in the targets and strategies. Teresa McMillan, who's now the deputy in Federal Transit, was previously the policy director of the MPO, where James used to work. And what they've analyzed for the Bay Area, you can't get there any other way than with pricing. They've done every smart transportation strategy in the book, and they said, well, how far does that get us? And they said, without pricing, you can't get there. So it's going to be dicey in terms of getting cities, counties, and states to implement pricing because it affects the user just like gas tax. But eventually, in the array of public policy tools, I'll bet you that is a centerpiece of what's used.
Okay, we're out of time. Thank you for coming. I just say in closing that I find this discussion encouraging, despite the differences, and that a global deal might still be in the works, both on the climate bill and the transportation bill, and that one thing is clear, we all need friends. So maybe this is the first step in that direction. So thanks again, and let's thank our audience.